Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. More than 100 books have been written about legendary crooner Frank Sinatra. Every detail of his life seems to captivate: his career, his romantic relationships, his personality, his businesses, and his style. And now from Frank's closest confidant and eventual member of his management team, my pal Tony Opitasano has penned a new book called Sinatra and Me. Deep into the night, for more than 2,000 nights, Frank and Tony would converse about music, family, friends, great loves, achievements, successes and failures, disappointments, the lives they led, and the lives they wish they led. In these full disclosure conversations, Sinatra spoke of his close yet complex relationship with his father, his conflicts with record companies, his carousing in Vegas, his love affairs with some of the most beautiful women of his era, his triumphs on some of the world's biggest stages, his complicated relationships with his talented children, and most importantly, the dedication he had to his craft. Toward the end, no one was closer to the singer than Tony Opitasano, who kept his own rooms at the Sinatra residences for many years, often brokered difficult conversations between family members, and held the superstar entertainer's hand when he drew his last breath. Now, Tony's book, Sinatra and Me, pulls back the curtain to reveal a man whom history has in many ways gotten wrong. And to talk about it all is my good friend, Tony Opitasano. Tony, what's going on, my friend?
I'm doing fine, David. It's great to talk with you again.
You know what? A long time coming, because we've talked all the time for the better part of 6 or 7 years. And, you know, we always said, you know, when's this going to be a book? When is this going to come out? And there's something you said to me really early on, and you said, you know, I've got some great stories, but I would only tell the stories that Frank would be okay with me telling. And I thought that just said a lot about you.
Well, it's just something else that I think we had in common, you know, telling someone something in confidence and knowing that it would stay there, that speaks a lot about a friendship. And, you know, 23 years or 230 years, I don't plan to violate that confidence no matter what. And, you know, I'll tell you a quick funny aside. When I was taking meetings about actually bringing this book to fruition, that question came up, and they said, well, you know, what do you think you're going to tell? And there are things, you know, are there things that you wouldn't tell? And I said, well, yeah, sure. I said, there are things that I won't tell. I said, for two reasons. One is that I wouldn't want to break the confidence that we had in each other. I said jokingly, and the other one is, I know things that could possibly put me in a grave. So everyone in the meeting laughed, and one guy said, he says, well, I got an idea. I said, what's that? He says, how about we have you write two books and we'll publish the second one after you're dead?
You know, he's not wrong. That might be a good idea. I said there's going to be a part two. I'm sure you didn't fill all these stories into one book, because you've got so many of them. And here's the thing about this. You might have not told, you know, dirty stories that you shouldn't have been telling, but you've told stories that really no one's ever heard, because you've had a firsthand account for so many years with Frank. And I got to tell you, I love the way the book is laid out. You open up talking about the call you got in 98 and the opportunity you had to say goodbye to Frank, but then you pulled it back and pivoted to your story.
The general public, I think, would probably get more out of the book if they had just a slight vested interest in who I was and the commonalities of lifestyle and upbringing and everything else that Frank and I had that we shared. You know, our family history, our ethnicities, childhoods, the struggles to be in the business when one of our parents on both sides didn't really want us to be in the business. And I just thought that it would help the reader be invested in the journey.
Well, you were born in Brooklyn, right? I mean, so some parallels to Frank's early years as well. And your father, and I love this, once told you that he should have known you'd be hobnobbing with the rich and famous, because as a kid, you liked classy things. I like that.
Yeah, he said, I had a private suite 20 minutes out of your mother, and you had a private suite. I said, Dad, that was an incubator. What are you talking about?
Private suite. Nice. Nice. Well, I mean, you know, at a very young age, you know, you started playing the piano, the accordion, the guitar, and you were 13. I love the story that when you were in a Woolworth store, when you first discovered, you know, Frank's music in one of his albums.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Nearness of You. I went home and put that thing on, and just the richness of that voice opening that song a cappella, you know, it absolutely sent shivers through my spine. It just blew me away. It's not the pale moon. And then all of a sudden, Bill Miller came in on piano, and then the orchestra followed. Absolutely beautiful. I was hooked.
Well, and then fast forward, so to 1972, just 8 years, after you first discovered mm-hmm. Frank's music at 21, yeah. You met Sinatra and Gilly, I might add, but in the middle, really, of what was his self-imposed retirement, so to speak, so he really wasn't out there that much, but it was about mm-hmm. 2 a.m, and you met Gilly and talked to him, and he asked you to pick up a guitar, and the rest is history.
Yeah, well, I had already at that point had about a 6 month, 8 month history with Gilly because I discovered the club by way of a recording that Frank made in 1965 live at the Sands with the Basie Band, and he kept talking about Gilly's and Gilly's and Gilly's, and I'm saying, you know, when I get old enough to start playing clubs in the city, I got to check this place out, and I went in, and it was right next door to what was the Albert Theater back in those days. Now it's the Gershwin. And there's a club still there. It's now called the Russian Samovar, 256 West 52nd. But Uncle Frank, Gilly's older brother, ran the club in his absence when he was on the road with Frank, with the singer. And so I struck up an accord with Uncle Frank, and then he said, you got to meet my brother, and Gilly and I clicked. And then Gilly, when he got to know me a bit and knew that I didn't have any kind of an agenda, he said, I think I'd like to introduce you to the old man. I think you guys would be a good fit. And so, yeah, that night, Frank had come into New York because Frank Jr. was appearing at the Rainbow Room, and they were going to the midnight show, and Gilly called me, and he said, don't talk it up, but the old man's going to be in town. If you're doing a gig or something, swing by the club. I want to put you two guys together. And that's how it started.
Wow. Wow. And it was picking up a guitar and just start playing. 2 a.m, after a couple Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. Well, more than a couple Jack Daniels.
Yeah, arbitrarily he would close the club. Well, technically he would close the club at 4 o'clock, but if you backed yourself up with 3 rounds, he wouldn't chase you out till 5:30, depending on what kind of mood he was in. You know, as long as no cash went across the bar, everything was cool.
Yeah, right.
So this particular night, he closed the club right at 4, chased everybody out. He says, the old man wants to hang out and I want him to hear you play. So he had me sit in with the trio with Joe Patrone and Lou Berryman. And we clicked. We were there till about 6 or 6:30 in the morning, and it was just, I kept pinching myself, to tell you the truth. And then later that day, when I finally drove home to Long Island, I got home just in time for my parents. My father was having his cup of coffee, getting ready to go to work. He worked in a defense plant, believe it or not. And Frank loved this story. I walked in and I was still in my tuxedo and I'm just gushing how I just spent the last 4 hours with Frank Sinatra, blah, 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 blah. And I noticed my father hadn't even looked up from the newspaper. And he hears his buddy's horn out front and he folds up the paper and he puts it down, takes his coffee cup, he goes over to the sink and he's rinsing it off. He goes out in the hall and he's putting on his jacket and his hat. And I said to Mom, I said, excuse me a minute. I went out in the hall and I says, Dad, and he's not even looking at me. He says, yeah. I says, were you listening? I just spent the last 4 hours with Frank Sinatra, and I played, and he sang with me and everything like that. And as he turns, as he's grabbing the doorknob to walk out the door, he looks at me and says, does that mean I can retire now?
Oh, jeez. That was his response. Oh,
yeah.
Man.
But the PS of the story is later on that afternoon, I canceled all of my private students that day because I was exhausted. And I said to Mom, I'm going to go pick up Dad at work. And typical winter in New York, I'm sitting there in the parking lot of the factory, 5:30, and everyone's punching out. And one by one, all of my dad's friends that knew me came by the car and they're knocking on the window saying, "Hey, Tony, that's great. Congratulations, man." But my father told every single one of them, but he wouldn't give me any credit whatsoever.
Yeah, but you know, but it must have been the back end at the very least, because you probably knew your dad and knew what type of guy he was and how he was going to react, that hearing it from his friends that he was proud of you and he was excited for you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You were talking a little bit about Uncle Frank. You know, people, when they hear the word Uncle Frank, if they're a big fan of the Jimmy Kimmel Show, that was his uncle. That was the security guy on stage. And I remember hanging out backstage with you and Don and Barbara Rickles some years ago talking about Uncle Frank. And I had no idea that he was a policeman, but he also served as security for Sinatra himself. He was in that circle.
Yeah, well, when he retired from NYPD, now it's funny because Jimmy's Uncle Frank and Jilly's brother Frank were two different people, obviously. But Jilly knew Frank Potenza, Jimmy Kimmel's Uncle Frank, from New York, when he was a cop.
Yeah.
So when he retired from NYPD, because the rest of the family had already taken up root and moved to Las Vegas. I mean, Jimmy was born in Brooklyn, and I think he left and moved to Vegas when he was like 4 or 5. So Uncle Frank picked up with Aunt Chippy and the three girls and moved to Las Vegas. And he got in touch with Jilly, and he said, "Listen, you know, I'm in Vegas. I'm new. I don't know anybody. And Frank is on the contract at Caesars. Do you think maybe you could put in a word? Maybe I'll get a job as a security guard there." And that's partially how it came to be.
Wow.
And if you're familiar with Uncle Frank, God love him, Potenza, he was a character and a half. And sometimes he'd be in his own world. And it wasn't intentional. It's just who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Jimmy this story one time I happened to be up in Vegas and was in touch with Jilly. And he says, "Listen, I'll call you tomorrow when the old man gets up. Maybe you can join us. We'll grab some breakfast." Well, breakfast is 3 p.m., naturally. So he calls me up and he says, "Listen, the old man doesn't want to eat in the suite. We're going to go down to the coffee shop, but meet us at the suite and we'll walk down together." Okay. So I met them at the suite, and who's standing outside the door, because he was appointed to be security because that's how he got the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Uncle Frank Potenza. So we get in the elevator. Well, downstairs, we're walking across the casino floor to get to the coffee shop, and a guy looks up from the crap table, and he sees Sinatra, and he yells across the room, "Hey, Frank, how you doing, buddy?" And before Sinatra got a chance to open his mouth, Uncle Frank Potenza goes, "Pretty good. I got a nice job. I'm making a living. I ain't gonna complain." And Sinatra looked at me and Jilly, and he says, "Am I in the room or what?"
That's awesome. All right, we're talking to Tony Opisano. His new book is Sinatra and Me, and there's more after the news next on 720 WGN. State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Sinatra friend, confidant, and manager Tony Opisano. His new book is Sinatra and Me in the Wee Small Hours. So let's talk a little bit about Jilly. And not only was he a very close friend of Frank's, he was a big part of Sinatra's life, but he was a friend of yours and he was a mentor to you.
Yes, he was. He surely was. And I don't know if I'd ever have. Well, I might have met Mr. Sinatra at some point, eventually a different way, but no way with the endorsement that came with Jilly having his arm around me and the trust that was automatically in place as a result of that. And Jilly was a hell of a guy. He really was. He helped a lot of people during his life, and in his mind, his enjoyment and his payback was watching people get where he felt they deserved to be. That's just the kind of guy he was. He was a big guy, you know. He was an impressive man, and he had a very big presence, but at the heart of the matter, he was really just a sweetheart.
Well, we're talking to Tony Opisano. His new book is Sinatra and Me, and there's more after the news next here on 720 WGN. State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Sinatra friend, confidant, and manager Tony Opisano. His new book is Sinatra and Me in the Wee Small Hours. You would be, on the road with Frank, and you've shared some stories on how some of the best moments of his shows, just as a performer, like you were in his circle, you were in his management team, but some of his best performances were unplanned on stage. And a lot of it was changing lyrics to songs, mm-hmm. adapting it to the city, or just being funny because he was just having fun with the audience.
Yeah, you know, I to clear up the technicality of it, I became his road manager when Jilly passed away. And that was my capacity, for 3 years while he continued to work. But, yeah, he would have fun. He would have fun with stuff. I mean, for one example, there was a great song, and he liked to just see if the audience would get it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he started singing one night, "You're nobody and nobody loves you. You're nobody and nobody cares." Now, that's not the original lyric.
Right, right.
But obviously, "Miss the Saturday." Well, that one I can't tell. That's dirty.
Okay.
"She went upstairs to get undressed. She came down without a chest. It's magic." Those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
he loved doing that.
You toured with him. You were obviously in awe of his music and his style and his persona. But, you were a stage performer as well. I mean, you were singing in clubs. You were out there doing that. And obviously, being in Frank's circle and part of his team, was it a difficult decision for you, or an easy decision to join Frank, but some disappointment of not being on stage yourself?
You know, it's kind of like a bit of an ache that never goes away, because let's face it, it was a big part of myself that I thought I was going to be doing for the rest of my life. However, I gave up my performing career in the early 80s only because it seemed like the smart thing to do. I had to keep compromising, as I used to say, my musical integrity just to continue to work. I was no longer doing the Great American Songbook because the industry itself had its hand in turning the public away from that, and the attention was going to disco, and then from disco it went to grunge, and from grunge to heavy metal. And so I turned my sights on producing, and I was doing TV and film and doing more and more things with Jilly as a result of that. He was helping me get talent, people that I didn't know. And also we started handling people together, like Joey Villa. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing more and more things together. And as the way it worked out, I spent more and more time down in the desert. So it only reinforced my friendship with Frank, starting in the early 80s and through the mid 80s. And then, you know, when the time came, unfortunately, when Jilly left us, by then I was already someone that Frank implicitly trusted. And it seemed like a natural fit for me to end up where I was at the end of his life.
You said radio and stuff kind of turned people away from the Great American Songbook. And I know Frank detested, he wasn't a big fan of rock and roll, obviously. And, he felt some of the bigger singers of the day on his coattails a little bit, but he did some albums in the late 70s and the 80s, even mm-hmm. into the very early 90s that really did kind of capture some of those more contemporary pop culture songs, but totally in his style.
In his own style. And, I got to give credit where credit is due on that. I was and still am a huge fan of Nelson Riddle. However, due to both Bill Miller and Al Viola, they are the ones who had a bit of a hand in convincing Frank to try this other arranger, a monster by the name of Don Costa. Mm-hmm. Right. And Don Costa, and I should never have left out Billy May or Gordon Jenkins, obviously, but Don Costa is the guy who kind of brought Frank as close to exactly what was happening,
in music
contemporaneously then.
Yeah.
And again, as I've said in another interview, I think with you, part of the reason that he went to that self-imposed retirement, in addition to wanting to spend more time with his friends and family, is that he told me this in later years, he was not convinced that he was relevant to my generation and had anything to offer us.
It's amazing when you think about the greatest, singer of the 20th century is Sinatra, mm-hmm. that he felt that way about himself.
Well, that's how much of a regular guy he was,
yeah.
You know, that other persona was built up in the press and everything else. When you got to know the man, he was as sensitive about things like that as you or I would be. And he also felt that he owed the general public the very best that he could do, because he, as he used to say, these are the people that paid the freight that got me where I am. And if I can't give them the very best that I'm capable of, then I'll walk away. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but that's how dedicated he was to his craft.
I think it was somewhere in Europe. It was Don and Jilly and Frank and you, and you're all having a bunch of drinks and probably overserved a little bit. It's a great story if you could share that.
Yeah, he was actually there on holiday and was sitting in the lounge, and all of a sudden this horrific thunderstorm came blowing in. And there were musicians on stage and were listening to music, but all Frank noticed was the flashes of the lightning. And he turned and he said, "Tell those damn guys if they don't stop taking my picture," because we were sitting against a plate glass, "if they don't stop taking it, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to take that damn camera," and blah, blah. And so, outside they go, and they're going, "What are we going to do? It's a storm. What the hell?" Well, luckily, the storm was moving very quickly, and it was moving in the direction away from where we were. So they stayed outside for about 10 minutes. They came back in, and there was absolutely all of it was gone. And Frank looked over and says, "Nice job, guys. That's terrific."
That's great. One of my favorite stories, honestly.
I never saw Don Rickles cross himself as though we were Catholic before.
I bet. We're talking to Tony Opinasato. His new book is Sinatra and Me, In the Wee Small Hours. And there's more with him next on 720 WGN. State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Sinatra friend, confidant, road manager Tony Opinasato. His new book is Sinatra and Me, In the Wee Small Hours. You know, you open and close the book with some impactful stories about the end of Frank's life. And first, he trusted you. First of all, he gave you some great gifts, you know, over the years that, you know, are still near and dear to your heart.
I guess probably the single most important, because of what it represents, is when he asked me, we're down in the desert. This is not long before he gave up the compound and moved up to Los Angeles permanently for the rest of his years. And he said, "I'd like for you to do me a favor." We were sitting out by the pool. It was about 4 a.m. And I said, "Sure, anything." And he says, "I'll meet you in the theater." He had this freestanding theater. You wouldn't know that that's what it was. It looked like it was a beautiful building, and it had big sofas and a bar. But at the end of the room, there was a screen behind the drape. But anyway, I went into the theater, and a few minutes later, he comes out of the house, and he walks into the theater with this valise in his hand, and he puts it down on the table, and he says, "The contents of this valise," he says, "are things that I've been putting aside," he says, "since the 1930s, he said, "and for the record, every single thing in this thing, in this valise, predates my relationship with Barbara. So when the right time comes, and you'll know when that is," he said, "I would like for you to make certain that the contents of this valise gets to my blood relatives, to my children, and to Mrs. Nancy." He says, "I don't want the contents of this valise to become part of a tug of war between Barbara and the kids." And I said, "Fine, Frank, I'll take care of it." And he proceeded to open it up and take the items out one by one and explain what they were and how they came to be and all of that stuff. And then he closes it up and he said, "And you know, I have something I need to give you too." I said, "Frank, it's not necessary." And he says, no, please." And he pushes this jewelry box across the table. He says, "I want you to have that." And I opened it up, and it was the pinky ring with his family crest on it. Wow. And he said, "I want you to know something else about that ring." I said, "Okay." He said, "First of all, I've come to think of you as an extended part of my family." He says, "So I really want you to have that." He says, "And further to that," he said, "you know, I used to wear that very ring on my left hand." He says, "But when I married Barbara, I put a wedding ring on my left hand." He says, "And I tried to put that on my right hand, but as you know, I broke my hand doing Manchurian Candidate. and my pinky calcified and it never quite healed, and that ring would not fit over his knuckle. So he had a replica of it made, and that's what he was wearing for the rest of his life. And so he said, I want you to have that. Wow. And I was very, very overwhelmed with that, and I still wear it on my right hand to this day. I didn't have to even resize it, believe it or not.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
And,
well, you know,
there's more to the story, but that I'll save that because it's politically incorrect. But at least I got him to laugh, like he got me to laugh as a result of it.
Right. Well, you were hanging a lot.
And the other,
you'll get him, sir.
The other part of it, which I'm sorry to interfere because I want you to know, I think you do know. Frank did respect me as a musician and a singer, and he also lamented that I gave up my performing career because he knew that it bothered me that I knew that I would never earn a gold record as a singer. I've earned gold records as a producer, but I've never earned a gold record as a singer. And so in addition to giving me this ring, when I got back to my condo in Toluca Lake a week and a half or so later, there was a package waiting. And I said, well, what the hell is this? I just left them. And I opened it up, and there's a short note, and it said, this is for you. There's no discussion. And I unwrapped it. Not only was it one of his gold records, it was his gold record of My Way.
Oh, whoa. Wow.
And I almost fell onto the floor. And just to cheer you up a little bit, I picked up the phone out of reflex and I called the house and I spoke with Vine, and we used to have a code word jokingly. And she picks up the phone. I said, is the gorilla up? And she said, yeah, he's having his breakfast. So it was about 4 p.m. He's having his breakfast. I said, would you please tell him I'm on the phone and I need to speak with him. Mm-hmm. So she pulls the phone away from her ear and she said, Mr. S, yes, sweetheart. Tony O's on the phone and he wants to talk to you. And I heard Frank chuckle. And I'm going to clean up the language. I heard him chuckle, and he says to her, tell him to read the note again.
That's awesome. Great.
And he wouldn't
story.
Talk to me.
No, right. right. Well, again, I mean, that was your relationship, and it was like that for decades. And, you know, you so often hung out with Frank and at their home, and spent a lot of time with one another. But at the end, you know, your presence was, you know, also allowed Barbara to get out of the house while providing Frank with some companionship that he needed. And you were there for those final moments of Frank's life. And I don't think either of you would have had it any other way.
No, it's something that I treasure. And as I've said, it may sound perverse to some people, but I also treasure the fact that I was afforded the opportunity to literally be with him as he left this plane, because I don't know how I would have handled it, given our relationship, if I had just gotten a phone call and said, listen, I got bad news, Frank died. I honestly don't know. I mean, it was extremely emotional, obviously, but it was also a bit comforting, knowing that he passed very peacefully and Barbara was standing by my side, and just the two of us. Even Dr. Kennemer had the good sense to leave us alone in the room because there was nothing more they could do for him. And it was just a moment that it's locked in my memory for the next 10,000 years, trust me.
We've only touched upon a few of the stories in this amazing new book, including that story about Frank Sinatra, Sinatra and Me in the Wee Small Hours. You can pick it up at Amazon and at your local bookseller as well. Tony, always love spending time talking to you, my friend. You know, just in general, we have a great time having conversations and stuff, but your Sinatra stories are always legendary, and I'm so glad you put them into this book because it's really just a tremendous read.
Well, thank you, my friend, and it's always an honor for you to ask me to come on your program, and a smile comes to my face whenever I look down, no matter when it is, and I see that you're giving me a call.
Awesome.
I appreciate your friendship and your support more than I can tell you.
As do I. Thanks, buddy. And I can't wait for the new book. I'll read that after you're gone.
I'll come back and visit you and see how you like it.
I know you will. Right. Thank you. Tony Opisano, Sinatra Me. Thanks, buddy.
Take care, pal.
All right. Top stories for the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom are next here on 720 WGN.